Good evening, my name is Russell. I'm an alcoholic. I'm a member of the Carl Gables Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's good to be here. Very exciting coming up here. We've got this little fender bender. Luckily, I had George to defend me. He spoke eloquently to the police officer, and when he was done, I was lucky I wasn't put in the electric chair. We'll talk a little bit more about that later on. I have some things I want to read. I like to sort of read some stuff that I don't think, you know, these days in AA, unfortunately, I think, and I may be wrong about this, there's not a lot of, there doesn't seem to be a lot of emphasis on reading the material. And I mean not only the big book or the 12 and 12, but Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers and the Sermon on the Mount, which was sort of like required me when I came in. I had the book I used 29 years ago was the Meditations before we had the Daily Meditation. All my sponsors and old timers used the 24-hour book, which is a combination of the Bible and I think the King James Version, not even the New King James Version, and the book Alcoholics Anonymous, and sometimes the 12 and 12 or something like that. And this is what I got sober on, and this is what my sponsors got sober on, my sponsors, and things like that. And these days, you're lucky if you find somebody that's actually knowledgeable about the book, big book, let alone the other books. So I like to read stuff from those documents. So I'm going to do, I want to start off tonight, though, by reading something from As Bill Sees It. It's on page 100. It's called The Forgotten Mountain. When I was a child, now this is from AA Comes at Age, of Age, another AA big book, another AA conference approved literature. It's not too many conference disapproved stuff. When I was a child, I acquired some of the traits that had a lot to do with my insatiable craving for alcohol. I was brought up in a little town in Vermont under the shadow of Mount Aeolus. An early recollection is that of looking up at this vast and mysterious mountain, wondering what it meant and whether I could ever climb that high. But I was presently distracted by my aunt, who as a fourth birthday present made me a plate of fudge. For the next 35 years, I pursued the fudge of life and quite forgot about the mountain. So I want to talk about fudge tonight. What's your fudge? What's your fudge? You think when you got rid of the alcohol, maybe you got rid of the fudge. No more fudge. I don't know. We'll see. The fudge of life. So let me read a couple of other things from Bill Wilson stuff and big book stuff. This is from some Bill Wilson writings, some stuff you won't hear around AA meetings too much. This is a little something about emotional sobriety. They asked Bill Wilson, he called it the next step, step in Alcoholics Anonymous, the next frontier. It's called emotional sobriety. That is those adolescent urges that so many of us have for top approval, perfect security, and perfect romance. Urges quite appropriate to age 17 prove to be an impossible way of life when we are at age 47 or 57. I could not avail myself of God's love until I was able to offer it back to Him by loving others as He would have me. And I couldn't possibly do that so long as I was victimized by false dependencies. Bill Wilson said, after the alcohol, it's all about unhealthy dependencies. For my dependency meant demand, a demand for possession and control of people and the conditions surrounding me. And when you talk about dependencies, I like to talk about idols. In biblical terms, an idol is something other than God. You know, in AA, well, you may not realize this sometimes in fellowship. you don't realize this, we talked about it last week, but if you read the big book, there's a lot in there about developing a relationship with God. As a matter of fact, on page 29 of the big book, when it talks about telling our testimonies, it says, further on, clear-cut direction are given showing how we recovered. These are followed by 42 personal experiences. Each individual in the personal stories describes in his own language and from his own point of view the way he established his relationship with God. That's what we talk about in Alcoholics Anonymous. That's what an AA story is about. You may think it's about getting drunk and falling down, or drinking a lot, or all the funny things that happen when we're drinking, all the terrible things that happen when we're drinking. But a true AA story, what we share, what is our spirit, experience, strength, and hope, is not so much the drunk log, although that may be important before at the beginning of the story. It's the solution that's important. That's what we're in here for, the solution. And the solution in AA lingo has to do with developing a relationship with God. So it says here, in biblical terms, an idol is something other than God that we set our hearts on. A talks about God, talks about developing a relationship with a higher power. Apparently, there's dependencies in here that will sort of like deflect you away from that deal. We call it idols. We call it the fudge of life. The fudge. In biblical terms, an idol is something other than God that we set our hearts on, that motivates us, that masters or rules us, or that we serve. An idol is something within creation that is inflated to function as God. All sorts of things are potential idols, depending only on our attitudes and actions towards them. Idolatry may not involve explicit denials of God's existence or character. It may well come in the form of an over-attachment, a dependency, to something that is in itself perfectly good. An idol can be a physical object, a property, a person, an activity, a role, an institution, a hope, an image, an idea, a pleasure, a hero, anything that can substitute for God. And this is a great line I love from John Calvin. It says, the human heart is a factory of idols. Every one of us, from his mother's womb, is expert in inventing idols. Cool stuff. I like that stuff. So next time you're in a meeting and you hear somebody complaining or whining or talking about anything that's bothering them, ask yourself this question. Is he talking about God? Is he talking about the solution? Is he talking about what we're supposed to be focusing in here on? Or is he talking about some fudge? Is he talking about the fudge? His own personal fudge? Is he talking about an idol? Is there something going on in his life that he's talking about because he doesn't have control over it, or he's worried about losing it, that fits into one of those categories that's important to him? And I say that as a person that has a lot of idols and a lot of fudge and stuff going on. And finally, I want to read from this until we get into it, and that is from the book, Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers. Dr. Bob, you know, in my way of thinking, this is my opinion, I've been around, it'll be 29 years in January, was, I guess, whether you want to call him the spiritual giant, he wouldn't have called himself the spiritual giant, he's a very humble guy, but whereas Bill Wilson had a lot of wonderful things to say, a lot of profound things to say, he was moving and shaking, he's the one who wanted to make AA like a profit organization, you know, host hospital, you know, he's the guy who saw himself, you know, really, you know, making a few bucks in AA, you know, and that's when Rockefeller said to him, but wouldn't money ruin it? Can you imagine? There's Bill Wilson think of, I'll be king of AA or something, and be the Bill Gates of AA, and we'll have hospitals, we'll have things all over the place, you know, and Nelson Rockefeller says, yeah, but wouldn't money ruin this thing? Wilson probably wanted to slap him or something, you know, and, but Dr. Bob was more or less sort of like the guy who was focused. You know, the whole thing started in 1939 out in Akron with Bob and Bill. Bill and Bob, they were the first two. And then they went out and met the guy in the bed. There, you see that guy, Bill Dotson. You know, by the time Bill and Bob met Bill Dotson, Bill had a few more months, 6 months more than Bob. And that was when Bill Wilson was looking at Bill Dotson and his wife Henrietta and saying, you know, the Lord's been so... The Lord has been so wonderful to me, curing me of this terrible disease that I have to keep on talking about it and telling other people. That's what Bill Wilson was saying 6, 7, 8 months sober. You know, before he got cool. You know, Bill Wilson, I don't know how many people, I don't know if you know this, and I love Bill Wilson. I'm not putting him down, but I don't know how many people know this. Y'all understand that Bill Wilson was an alcoholic? Listen, you need to understand something about Bill Wilson. He was an alcoholic just like you and me. He wasn't God. You know, I love Bill Wilson. I look up to him. I read his stuff. He has a lot of good stuff, but you want to know something? He ain't my higher power. He was not God. Neither was Dr. Bob or anything like that. And he would never claim to be that to you. You know, there's some things he did. You're going to hear about some stuff he did, which is going to remind you a lot about you. It's going to remind you a lot about, you know, what you hear in AA. You know, they're going to hear some stuff we're going to talk about. So that's why I love this book, because this book talks about what was going on in AA between 1935 and 1939. It gives me a new perspective on things, you know, because I heard so much, and we talked about this last week, but I want to talk about it some more, about rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. We have this thank God we have this book. What would be going on with AA today if we just went with the whim of the crowd or the lowest common denominator? Seeing as how we're all people that we don't want to be rejected, we want to be liked, we want people to think we're cool, you know, what would happen to AA today if an AA room was pretty basically, you know, just what the crowd wanted AA to be? Whatever you made up in your own mind, whatever you figured you want, and you know, pretty much, quite frankly, in my opinion, that's sort of like the way AA is. I mean, every once in a while you get an old timer, because it's gotten so large. There's so many people being thrown in here, you know, and maybe the old timers, they might have thought that was the greatest thing in the world, you know what I mean? But it's gotten so huge with people coming in from, and there's nothing wrong with this. I'm not saying there's anything wrong with this, but they fly in from treatment centers. They fly in from court. They fly in from being ordered to be here. There are people that come in here that don't think they should be here. The people here come here that want to be here. There are people that are desperate. You know, you can't rob an alcoholic of his desk. It says in the big book, if you want what we have and you're willing to go to any length to get it, then you're ready to take certain steps. There are people that are ready. There are people that want what we have. There's people that don't even have a we. They don't even know what we have. And you want us, and there are people that not only don't they want what they have, they want anything but what we have. They don't even know what we have. And there are some people that want what we have. They're just not willing to give up the fudge. They're just not ready. They're going to be ready. You know something? They're going to be ready in 5 years. You know, in 29 years of doing this stuff, you know how many people come up to me and say, how many people will come up to you and say, how long have you been in AA? He says, well, I've been around for 30 years. Now, I know what that means. That's AA code, right? You know, I went to my first meeting 30 years ago. And, you know, if I actually stayed here, I'd have 30 years, but I have 6 months now. But this time I'm really going to do it. And they've been back and forth and back because they weren't ready. They were like dilettantes coming into this thing. Sort of like testing the waters until it got too tough, you know, because they had their eyes on the... Sometimes it takes a long time. You got everybody coming in here, tons of people. Back then, in the day, the people that were coming in were incredibly desperate. They were so desperate, they would do anything to stay sober. They had to prove. They had to prove. Can you imagine that? If you couldn't get into an AA room unless you could prove to their satisfaction that you really wanted it. Imagine what the AA meetings would be like, what we'd be talking about, what you'd be acting like, who you would be listening to, what you would be saying, if you would be saying anything, if you could not get in here unless you were sponsored in here and you could prove that you were acceptable here. That sounds kind of crazy to you, but that's the way it was from 1935 to 1939. Now, we sit here because we're selfish and self-centered and we have a certain perspective and we go to a lot of meetings that when we read in the big book, rarely have we seen the person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. You know what we think about? We think about ourselves. Because we always think about ourselves anyway. That's all we think about, ourselves. Me, 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 me. You know, ourselves, it's like, you know, driving the trap. We just think about what we see. So when we see rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path, our frame of reference is what we do. What we think, here's what we think. We think that they thought, the old timers thought, the guys who wrote this book, we think they thought like we thought. That they read the books or didn't read the books that we read. That they acted like we acted. As a matter of fact, here's what we think. We think the meetings they went to were just like the meetings we go to. And we think the things they were told to do are just like the things they were told to do. So what we think is when we say rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path, we think if we're doing what everybody else is doing in the fourth dimension room, then we're doing exactly what they were doing. And therefore, since rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path, if we're doing what everybody else is doing in here or in the back on track group, we think we should be getting and experiencing exactly what they were getting and experiencing. Right? That's what we think. But we don't know. But do we do in AA what they were doing from 1935 to 1939? Do it. Do you? You'd have to figure that out. How would you figure that out? You have to read about it. Now, here's the deal. The big book was written. You can't say, well, they were reading the big book. I read the big, even if you read the big book. Because between 1935, because when they wrote the book, when they wrote down, rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path, when they wrote those words, they wrote that in the big book in 1939 about what they were doing between 1935 and 1939, those 4 years. So the one thing we know they weren't doing is reading the big book. So we know they weren't reading the big book. We know they were meeting. We know there was something about the Oxford group. We're not really sure what they were doing. So I want to read you a couple of things from this. You know, I just want to do whatever I can to screw you up. It ain't going to hurt but a second, you know what I mean? I'll be done in less than 10 minutes. And if I can just screw you up a little bit, it won't hurt. It's no big deal, you know? But you see, here's the great thing. The great thing about AA, the way AA works is like this. You hear shit. You see, the problem you have, this is the problem you have. You see, once it goes in, you understand? Once it goes in, you can't get it out. You'll never be the same. You could try to be the same. You could try to make believe you didn't hear. You can act like you didn't say it. But once it goes in, you're changed. It's like the hard drive is changed. You can't. It's done. You know what I mean? The damage is already done. And then when you hear somebody say something at a meeting, what'll happen is you'll flip back to this deal without even knowing it. You'll start thinking about this deal. It may not be a bad thing, though. It may not be a bad thing, though. I caution you, though. You know, I'm a professional. Don't you try to do this at other meetings, okay? I don't want to see anybody injured, you know? I mean, you have, like, about 28 years, so they're, like, maybe a little scared of you or something, you know? Or they figure, well, he's an old guy. He's not going to be around here long anyway. So I'm just from Dr. Bob in the good old times. I'm going to read just about four things to you, okay? You're going to like this stuff. This is fun stuff. You don't hear about this in meetings, you know? Just a little shoot you if you talk about this in meetings, okay? Here we go. Page 71. According to Bill and Smith, now this is all stuff that happened between 1935 and 1939, before the big book was written. This is the stuff, this is what they were doing. According to Bill, Ann Smith had decided that practical steps needed to be taken to protect her husband's newfound sobriety. She invited Bill to come to live with them. There I might keep an eye on Dr. Bob and he on me, Bill said. The invitation came at an appropriate, opportune time. Bill was about broke, even though he had received some money from his partners in New York, and was again hoping to come out ahead in a proxy fight that had first brought him to Akron. For the next 3 months, I mean, this guy's only sober. He's sober less than a year. How many people are sober? How many people have less than a year? He is exactly where you are. You get it? This is where he is, okay? This is what he's doing. And I know all you guys are doing this. He's living with somebody else. It's not a halfway house, but it's sort of like he's living with somebody else. He's broke. He has no money, okay? For the next 3 months, I live with these two wonderful people, Bill said, and I shall always believe they gave me more than I ever brought them. Each morning, there was a devotion, he recalled, after a long silence in which they awaited inspiration and guidance. Anne would read from the Bible. This is what he did for the first 3 months and even before. Anne would read from the Bible. Try that at your next A&A meeting. But this is what they did. Hey, listen, this isn't like satanic material. This is like conference approved. This is published by AA. Okay? It's the real deal. Each morning there was a devotion, he recalled, after a long silence in which they awaited inspiration and guidance. Anne would read from the Bible. James, the book of James, was our favorite. If I was to tell somebody who I sponsored, if they said, what do you want me to do? I said, I want you to read the book of James. You know, there'd be about 50,000 people and they'd say, what are you, religious? What are you this? We're not about this. We're spiritual, not religious. And I'd say, well, that's the way you do it. That's not the way I do it. I believe in doing it the old-fashioned way, the way they did. I believe in doing it the way they did. Not the way you want to do it, just because you don't like it. But I don't like it. But I say, but the fact that you like it worries me, because you're like into the fudge. You like to do things your way. You like the fudge of life. You like to do things that you like that taste good. You like the fudge. And the fact whether you like it, or the fact that you like it indicates to me that it's probably wrong. James was our favorite, he said. Reading from her chair in the corner, she would softly conclude, "Faith without works is dead." This was a favorite quotation of Anne's, much as the book of James was a favorite with early AAs. When they say, rarely have I seen a person fail who's thoroughly followed their path, part of their path was constantly reading and memorizing the book of James. They almost called us the James Club. So much so that the James Club was favored by some as a name for the fellowship. Sue also remembered the quiet time in the mornings, how they sat around reading from the Bible. Later, they also used the Upper Room, a Methodist publication that provided daily inspirational message, its denominational in its approach. Remember, this is rarely have we seen a person fail, it's thoroughly followed our path. Every time you hear that in an AA meeting, you think about them sitting around reading the Bible. Don't think about them sitting around doing what's going on in the 12-step room, or in the call room, or in the fourth dimension club. They didn't do that. Think about what was going on back then. This is what they were doing. You know, if you start thinking in terms of that, then when you read this thing where you hear we've experienced much of heaven, we've been rocking the fourth dimension of existence of which we not even dream. There is one that has all power, that one is God, may you find him now. You know, you can't manage your own life, though human power, may God couldn't. When you hear stuff, see that your relationship with him is right and great events will come, you'll have a different sort, you'll sort of understand it in a different way. These people were religious. They were spiritual. They believed in God as a deity. They weren't ashamed of it. They were into this stuff. And then you'll ask yourself, is this really what's going on? Is this really what the deal is here? Or is it something a little bit different? Okay, now the next thing is on page 96. Dr. Bob, noting that there were no 12 steps at the time and that our stories didn't amount to anything to speak of, later said they were convinced that the answer to their problems was in the good book. You understand that's the Bible. To some of us older ones, the parts that we found absolutely essential. Absolutely essential. That means essential, but if you don't get it, like absolutely essential. Were the Sermon on the Mount, when I came in, it was required reading. You know, you could read from, or you could read Sermon on the Mount, Emmett Fox. It was absolutely essential reading 29 years ago. Sermon on the Mount, the 13th chapter of the 1 Corinthians, and the book of James, he said. This was the beginning of A's flying blind period. They had the Bible. They had the precepts of the Oxford group. They also had their own instincts. They were working out the AA program, the 12 steps, without quite knowing how they were doing it. This is AA back then. When you hear rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path, they're talking about this. They're not talking about what you're thinking they're talking about. Okay, this is page 101. This is what they did if you wanted to go to an AA meeting. Let's say you wanted to go to an AA meeting. Let's say you took you out of hospital and you wanted to go to an AA meeting. Okay? This is what you did. Okay? Page 101. On the other hand, we were taking them upstairs and getting them on their knees to surrender, which I felt was very important. The surrender was more than important. It was a must. It was a must. Bobby, who came to AA in February of 1937, recalled that after 5 or 6 days in the hospital, when you had indicated that you were serious, they told you to get down on your knees by the bed and say a prayer to God, admitting you were powerless over alcohol and your life was unmanageable. Furthermore, you had to state that you believed in a higher power who would return you to sanity. This is in 1937. Down on your knees. You ever hear somebody say, well, you might scare away the newcomer. You don't get any newer than get down on your knees off the hospital bed and say these things. You know, get them while they're weak. There you can see the beginning of the 12 steps, he said. We call that the surrender. They demanded it. You couldn't go to a meeting until you did it. If by accident you didn't make it to the hospital, make it in the hospital, you had to make it in the upstairs bedroom over the Williamson's house. Dorothy S.M. recalled the 1937 meetings when the men would all disappear upstairs and all of us women would be nervous and worried about what was going on. After about a half an hour or so, down would come the new man, shaking, white, serious, and grim. And all the people who were already in AA would come trooping down after him. They were pretty reluctant to talk about what happened, but after a while they would tell us that they had had a real surrender. I often wonder how many people that come in now would survive an experience like that. A regular old-fashioned prayer meeting, said Dorothy, who was then married to an AA member. Now, we do that today. Did you know we do that today? Well, we don't take them upstairs, get down on your knees, they start crying, say it's a real thing. This is what we do. We say, does anybody want a white chip? Well, if you're too scared to come up, I'll just sort of leave it right here. And you can pick it up when we're not looking. Well, you know, pick up. Not looking. Actually, we're lucky if they stand up. They don't want to come up. They want to sort of like hand deliver it like Domino's Pizza, you know? And you're not looking. Pick it up. There's a difference between what was going on back then and right now, isn't there? It gets better. Clarence S. I want to give a Clarence Snyder, the brewmaster. He was like the fourth guy or something like that who came in his stories in the book, okay, as to how he surrendered. He started the Cleveland Group. Cleveland Group was the group that was indicated that had the greatest success rate in AA. As a matter of fact, it was so great it looked almost like AA started there. This is what Clarence, this is how Clarence Snyder was 12-stepped. I went into this last week, I don't want to do it again, by Dr. Bob. Clarence S. was one of those who came from Cleveland at the beginning of 1938. Now this is 1938. This is the year before the big book. So this is consistent. This is what they were doing. To be fixed by Dr. Bob. His wife, who later became close to Ann, and Dr. Bob had talked to a number of ministers and doctors before her sister, Virginia, New York, who was a patient of Bill Wilson's brother-in-law, Dr. Leonard B. Strong, told her about Dr. Bob. Okay? I called Dr. Smith. This is his wife. I called Bob Smith, and I still remember my words and how gruff his voice was. Dorothy recalled the 1954 conversation with Bill. He scared me to death, I said. Is this the Dr. Smith who helps drunks? When he said yes, I wept. I wept and said that my husband was an alcoholic. This is this gal that she's crying on the phone. She's bawling. My husband's an alcoholic. Right away, he seemed to know how old, he wanted to know how old Clarence was. 34, I said. How many people here are 34 or less? Raise your hands. Okay, listen. 34, I said. Impossible, he replied. He hasn't suffered enough. There's never been anyone that young come to fellowship and recover. Now, this is what he says. This could have been one of Dr. Bob's tactics at the time to suggest that a newcomer wasn't ready because of being too young or being a woman or not having suffered enough. Prospects were thus, ready for this, forced to prove that they were indeed ready and willing to accept the program. Nowadays in Alcoholics Anonymous, the program almost has to do double backflips and turn themselves into a pretzel to beg people not to leave because we might mention God. We have to prove to them that we need them. We're more worried, God forbid, that they won't like us than whether they're ready to come in here. Do you think the attitude of AA has changed at all? You know? We're more ready to throw the program into the toilet. I mean, God forbid there's some new guy with 2 hours sobriety who hasn't paid his child support in 16 years and has ripped the hearts out of everybody he knows what we'd like to do is say, well, how would you like this program to work? And when he tells us, he says, let's just change the program to suit him so he won't be pissed off and leave. And then we might feel bad we're so codependent. Dr. Bob was about to hang up on me, Dorothy continued, but then he relented and said there was one man in Cleveland who might be able to help, Clarence. And he gave me Lloyd T's address. I went over to see Lloyd. He talked to me, but they were very secretive in those days. He didn't tell me what the solution was. I did know it was tied up with the Oxford Group, said Dorothy, which is an evangelical Christian group, who describes herself as being bitter and skeptical at the time. In other words, she's saying she's bitter and skeptical about what? About religion. Who isn't? How do you think they handled that? Do you think they sort of backed down? I think they said, well, don't worry, we're spiritual, we're not religious, or anything like that. She was desperate. I decided I would pretend to go along with it if Clarence took, you know what she's saying? Even though I hated religion, even though I was bitter, I decided I would go along with it anyway, if only they would take him in and work with him. In other words, she would go along with it and be a phony. Because she was so desperate if they would work with him. So she brought her husband a bus ticket to Akron. There, Clarence made arrangements to go to the hospital where he stayed for a week. Okay? Dr. Smith came in later and took over. He sat on the edge of my bed and said, so Dr. Smith sits on the edge of the guy's bed. He's sitting on the edge of your bed in the hospital. You're thinking about fudge and stuff. Fudge. Whatever your fudge is, Sally, George, money, clothes, cars, houses, you know, whatever you're thinking about. He sat on the edge of his bed. Well, what do you think about all this? He's talking to you now. He's sitting at the edge of your bed. He's saying, what do you think about all this? Then he paused and looked at me doubtfully. I don't know if you're ready yet. You're kind of young. I was down to 135 pounds, no job, no clothes, no money. I didn't know how much more ready I could be, recalled Clarence. Still, I had to convince them I was ready. You know, when they do The Man on the Bed, and Bill Wilson talks to Bill Dodson, he has this famous line, Bill and Bob go in there, and it's really the only time in the big book where you see Bill and Bob sort of like double-teaming the third guy in AA, and how they're talking, this is what he says. He essentially says something like this. He says to Bill Dodson, he says, listen, we have a deal where we're trying to help people. It requires that they get this, they believe in a higher power, not in themselves, and they pass on to other people. He said, and this is what he says. He says, if you want to go along with this, we're happy to try to help you, but if you have a problem with this, we'll not waste your time. We will not waste your time, and we'll go looking for someone who wants it. And I've always thought that what they were really saying is, we'll not waste our time, and we'll go looking for somebody who wants us. You know, everybody here is so worried, God forbid, an alcoholic will drink. You know, if an alcoholic's going to drink, you're going to drink. You can't rob an alcoholic of his desperation. You know, this is for people who want it, not people who need it. Then he asked, now here's Dr. Bob sitting at the edge of your bed. You're trying to prove to him you want it, and this is what he does. He pulls this crap on you. How's this? You're coming in the door tonight to go to the meeting, but you haven't done the knee thing. You managed to get out of the hospital without doing the knee thing, the on your knees thing. So you're walking through the door tonight. You heard somebody speaking. You want to see it. You go to the meeting. And then the guy comes up. This is what Dr. Bob did to him. He says, do you believe in God, young fella? Do you believe in God, young lady? He always called me young fellow. When he called me Clarence, I knew I was in trouble. Then Clarence says to Dr. Bob, what does that have to do with it? Dr. Bob says, everything. Everything. He didn't say, well, it's spiritual rather than religious, or don't worry about it, you'll get it, or God, I don't want to scare you away, or, you know, please like me, please don't reject me, you know, don't hurt my feelings, you know. He said, everything. Then the guy goes like this. He does the Alkie thing. He says, well, I guess I do. No, he does one of the, that's the way Alkie, you know Alkie, do you have a driver's license? Well, it's a long story, you know. Are you married? Well, sort of. Do you have a job? Well, look, it's like this, you know. I mean, there's no yes or no. It's like, you know, slide around, go around the corner, you know, duck underneath the Chevy. anything that he says, guess nothing. Either you do or you don't. Yes, I do. That's fine, Bob replied. Now we're getting someplace. All right, get out of bed and on your knees, we're going to pray. I don't know how to pray. I guess you don't. But that's all right. Just follow what I say, and that will do for now. I did what I was ordered to do, Clarence said. There was no suggestion. This isn't me saying this is the way AA should be. This is me reading from one of our books telling you what AA was. What it was. You don't have to like it. I'm just telling you what it was. Dr. Bob was always positive about his faith. Clarence said, if someone asked him a question about the program, his usual response was, what does it say in the good book? Suppose he was asked, what's all this first things first? Dr. Bob would be ready with an appropriate quotation, seek ye first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, and all these things shall be added unto you. Which is also in the big book. Along with a lot of other stuff. In the early days, she recalled, Bill said to me, Henrietta, this is your buddy Bill Wilson. After all the stuff I just read, this is Bill Wilson. Now, a few months after the fact, he was suggesting that he was cured because of what the Lord did for him, and he had to keep on talking about it. A few months after that, as people started coming through the doors, this is what he says to Henrietta. Have you ever heard this around AA? Have you ever heard anybody say this around AA? This is Bill Wilson. Just a few months after giving his life to God. Henrietta, in the early days, you recall, Bill said to me, Henrietta, I don't think we should talk so much about religion or God. He was worried that he might offend somebody. I mean, in the early days, he's running around saying, God is, you know, I can't stop talking about it. God has saved me. God. Now, all of a sudden, he probably said it to a couple of people and they laughed at him. And that was enough for him. I quit. Has that ever happened to you? Have you ever been sitting in a meeting and you want to say something to God, but you look around and say, well, they'll probably laugh at me. You want to talk about God, or you want to say something about God, you say, well, how is this going to play? You know, some guy talks about God, you say, man, they're going to beat the crap out of him. You worry about, you know, you're sort of watching everybody else. You know, you're a typical alcoholic. You're just sort of watching everybody else, see what you should say and what you shouldn't say so that everybody will think you're okay and not uncool. I mean, I would say what happened to you guys, because you guys are obviously a cut above. You know, most people in AA, you probably don't think that way. You know, you probably just don't like goal. You're like leaders, you know what I mean? You're not followers, you know, you guys are there, you know. But you know, Bill Wilson was that way. That was part of his fudge. That was part of his fudge was he needed people to accept him and to like him and to love him. And he needed praise. That was his fudge, and he didn't want criticism or judgment. That was a fudge thing. Bill said to me, Henrietta, you know, the problem with the fudge thing, it's like giving up the mouth. When you do the fudge thing with like me, then you don't get to live your life. You just basically live the life that you think other people want you to live in order for them to like you. And you sort of give away basically your integrity. And then you live a life totally in fear all the time without even knowing about what other people like you, whether they like you and your judgment. So you're always feeling crappy because you're always assuming all sorts of crap about other people. And it's one of the things that's on your mind. It's like a bad deal. You're hopping into a bad way of life instead of living life the way you want to live your life. And only be concerned about you and your relationship with God. You're always looking at the other people to see where they fit in. And most of the time, if you're an alcoholic, you don't think you do fit in. You got to call me up and figure out how to do the deal. So that's why you worry about money and cars and all that sort of stuff and have that overactive deal with all that sort of stuff because you really want people to like you. Because God knows without that stuff, you're a piece of shit and you don't like yourself. I'm not talking about you guys. I'm talking about the guys down at the car room. My group, you know what I mean? You guys are better than them, you know. Bill said to me, Henrietta, I don't think we should talk so much about religion or God. I said to him, well, we're not out to please alcoholics. They have been pleasing themselves all these years. We are out to please God. And if you don't talk about what God does and your faith and your guidance, then you might as well be the Rotary Club or something like that because God is your only source of power. Finally, he agreed. Do you believe that? Bill Wilson needed an old-timer or some gal to set him straight because he was about to throw God under the bus. And had he done that by the time he wrote the big book, had he not been corrected by somebody who loved him and said, look, this is the deal, this is why you're sober, we would not have a big book today. You wouldn't have a book say, the book wouldn't be saying there is one who has all power. The book wouldn't be saying, that one is God, may you find him now. He was ready to, that would have been out of the book.
Forget about as you understand them. There wouldn't have been any God at all. Forget about higher power. He was ready to chuck the whole thing because he was worried about how it would affect other people. He was ready to water this thing down so that everybody would come in and nobody would be upset. The lowest common denominator. You know, there's an old country song, you've got to stand for something or you'll fall for anything. There is no record, page 218. There is no record of what happened at the first meeting except for the grapevine account. Years later, noted that it was led by Dr. Bob, who put his foot on the rung of a dining room chair, identified himself as an alcoholic, and began reading the Sermon on the Mount. That's Matthew 5, 6, and 7 of the Bible. That's the first meeting in Alcoholics Anonymous. That's what was going on between 1935 and 1939 when they wrote the book, Rarely Have We Seen a Person Fail Who Has Thoroughly Followed Our Path. Now, how many of you guys are doing that at your meetings now? Zero. Nada. Forget it. So we just sort of walk around and cope. Not too many experiencing much of heaven's rocking in the fourth dimension of existence. Not too much enthusiasm. Not too many. And we lose spirit today, tomorrow, and the year after we were reborn. If you seriously do these things, all sorts of remarkable things will happen. All sorts of promises and things God is doing for us. Not too much of that stuff going on. Just sort of like, oh, hang it in there. How you hang it in there? Don't drink and go to meetings. We're not even doing this stuff. You know, it's like a recipe. It's like a recipe for a chocolate cake. I give you a recipe for chocolate cake. 2 eggs, flour, milk, whatever it is. Put it in the oven, 365. You do it exactly. You do this. You follow the recipe exactly. You got a chocolate cake. Right? I never made one. I don't know what it is. 360, whatever you put it. Okay, so here's the deal. I say, well, listen. I don't want to wait 20 minutes, you know, 40 minutes, 360 of these. How about 1 minute at 2,000 degrees? So, like, you know, up on one. Or how about this? I won't use eggs. I'll use, like, egg beaters. Or, you know, you know what I mean? I won't use, you know, flour. I'll use something that's sawdust. I don't know. Whatever. Or, you know, I won't use chocolate. It's too fattening. So I'll use, you know, whatever. Whatever you're going to use, okay? You won't, if you don't, you know, listen, my number is 305-442-0200. You dial 305-442-0200, you get my law office. You get me. You understand what I'm saying? Now listen to this. If you dial 305-442-0201, if you're like one digit off, you don't get me. You can dial it a million times. You ain't going to get me. You understand? This is a recipe book. You don't follow the recipe. You don't do the deal. You decide you want to change it because of the fudge or go here, go there. You ain't going to get the deal. You're going to get something. It's going to look like, it's going to smell like, it's going to feel like. You're going to think you even got it. And you're going to think you even got it because you don't know what it was they got. So you won't even know you're missing out on anything. You might say, because you think this is what you got, and your buddy Fred's got it, and some other guy's got it, and that's what they got in New York and Milwaukee. So you figure, this must be what it is. But then you read the book, and there seems to be some sort of difference there. It looks like maybe they were a little more religious. Maybe there was some sort of, they're using all this flowery language. And so you settle for this deal. And you think this deal is what you're studying for, and all you're doing is you're cutting yourself out of the real thing. Like Coke, the real thing. And that's the deal. So I'm driving up here with all this wonderful knowledge I have. And I'm going to end it now because I've got to end it. Like 10 minutes. So I'm driving with all this wonderful knowledge I have. And I'm driving up here. And I got into an accident. Now, it wasn't my fault. It wasn't my fault. It wasn't my fault. But... But we step on the selfishness, self-centeredness. That's the root of the problem. Through by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, we step on the toes of others and they retaliate. Usually without provocation, but sometimes we see we did think of the path that put in a position to be hurt. But since I knew it wasn't my fault, and since I knew there was no question it was the other gal's fault, I got out of my car and I was rude. I was rude. There is no question about it. I was rude. Okay? I did one of these things. Didn't you see what was going on? What are you doing? What are you crazy? What, you know, one of those deals. You know? Because apparently, I was with three other guys, and I was trying to give them a lesson and prove to them that I was indeed an alcoholic. So now every one of these guys, when I say my name's Russell, I'm an alcoholic, they'll say, yeah, he really is. No, no, you got to trust me on this. He really is. So, boy, I love being right. Oh, I love being right. Oh, I love being right. I love being right. Being right is great. And she was offended. And I said, offended? I said, let me tell you something. I'm calling the police. I'm calling the police. You were right. No, I was wrong. I'm calling the police. And I called the police. And George was my lawyer. He immediately spoke up in Spanish and English, told them the whole story, and they wrote me a ticket. And one of my buddies, you know, he's actually a co-deacon in the church, and he said, you know, I spoke to the lady. She said she wasn't even called the police to do anything if you weren't acting so rude. Got a little girl in the car. Nobody was hurt. It was like such a minor, it really was a minor thing. You know, it was such a minor thing. And, you know, the problem is, now, I've got to be honest with you. I do believe it wasn't my fault. I really, but you want to know something? I was so rude. I was so wrong. I should have gotten out of that car. I should have said, how are you? Are you okay? How is your little girl? Is everything? I should have said that. You know what I mean? I shouldn't have acted the way I acted. I know it. I know it. And I got to make amends for that. I got to make amends. I got to apologize to this lady, you know, for, I got to do that deal. You know? You know, you see, that ain't fudge for me. That's bitter. That's a bitter, you see, I like the hating her. And she was wrong, and I was right, and this is unfair. That's my fudge. That's my fudge. You understand what I'm saying? Sitting there with a resentment, saying the system's wrong, they were wrong, it's George's fault, I can't believe this, it's all, you know, look what happens to me, no matter what happens, life is unfair. That's my fudge. You know? Doing it my way, listen, I would rather think my thoughts and figure this thing out on my own, then read the Sermon on the Mount, the Bible, or the Big Book. Because my brain and my thinking is my fudge. This is not my fudge. This is not my fudge. This is not my fudge. Bible's not my fudge. My fudge is the way I think and the way I want. That's my fudge. The way I want to do things is my fudge. It's very hard to break from that deal. It's very hard to do it the other way. But if I don't, then I have that feeling of restlessness and guilt and irritability, which I wanted to drink about. That's why we drink, because we're restless, irritable, and discontented. I got to do it. You know what it says in the Big Book? It says we can't get rid of the fudge. We're addicted to the fudge. It says we've got to get rid of the selfishness. It says, and then it says, that's why we have God. God will do that. And very often it seems impossible to get rid of it without His aid. Thank you very much. All right. Thank you.